Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
You're welcome along. It's another edition of Golf Weekly. We have Nathan Murphy, Fionn Davenport, Peter Lawrie along for the ride. No major guest today. I'm quite looking forward, actually, to just chatting with us, Nathan. I think this is a nice return to just the gang for a couple of minutes.
Oh, you know, all these superstars coming in, taking up our time.
I agree.
Just a major stress right now. Hassle we don't need. Having to do, we like to do two podcasts every month. Just doing one or two a week.
Once the golf starts, we will revert to doing one or two a month. But for the time being, two a week is what we've averaged this week. Conor Moore was on yesterday. He was very good. That's available for download. You can get that in all the usual places. I would suspect it's right beneath the podcast you're listening to now. Peter Lawrie, how are you? You are not in your home today. What are you doing?
No, I'm not at home. I escaped today. The grass in Spawell badly needed cutting. So I took my big mower out and I've chopped it all up. I think under the laws of having to look after a golf course facility, I'm allowed out and cut grass. So I took liberty this morning and I'll be back home very shortly.
Very shortly, says the man who's going to sit in his office just staring at the wall for 4 hours just for a bit of peace and quiet.
Yeah, no, my kids are not at your age now, Nathan. My kids are a little bit older. The minute I come in the door, it's, Daddy, let's go play in the garden. So I've taught my son how to chip, which is not a mean feat.
Right.
He's eight, and he can chip the ball beautifully now.
Is he happy to be playing golf?
He toys between football, hurling, basketball, and golf now. So we'll try and get him over to the dark side soon enough.
Mm. And is it easy to teach an eight-year-old how to chip? What's the main tip?
No, it's not. It's I'm trying to get him to strike the ball. That's the big thing. Because I've been teaching him off AstroTurf, it's quite difficult to get underneath it. So he's learning from a difficult position.
It's a tight line.
I have a putting green in the back garden. Yeah. So instead of putting, now we're chipping to the holes.
Wow. Very good.
Who is your colleague down in Spawell that does the Kids Academy?
There's a couple of them. Brendan McDade does the kids on Sunday.
I was down there last summer, brought the kids down one day, just hit a few balls. And Brendan was doing a kids summer camp beside me, about 10 kids. So I was just about three bays down and my kids had never properly hit a golf ball before. So I was obviously, showing them the way. And I was... there was heads nearly taken off. It was just a very dangerous situation for everybody involved. And I was getting more and more annoyed. So I'm like, all right, the basics are, you just stand here like this. And Brendan came over and he was like, just let them hit the ball.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to give them the basics there. Have they played much? I was like, no, I've never hit a ball. He's like, just let them hit the ball. Mm. Let them swing. It's like, you can't expect them to have anything.
Yeah,
for a long, long time. So just let them enjoy it. They're not going to come back if it's bloody hell.
That's a good point. Yeah. You don't want them to associate it with one failing and two a lack of enjoyment.
Mm. Yeah, it was a very good lesson for dealing with children in general. But yeah, because it's so like particularly golf where you're no, and there is obviously the actually my eldest son had been to a range before when he went with a friend of mine and his son. And I wasn't there, and I didn't hear about this for about 3 months afterwards until eventually let it slip that my son had, turns out, incredible golfing ability. And while a ball was behind the bay, got a perfect connection and smacked it straight into the chest of the other guy's son.
Oh, lovely.
Much to his shock.
Yeah.
Well, the plan for today, there's a few bits of news to talk about and get your thoughts on. And then Fionn Davenport, you have read the Michael Bamberger book on Tiger Woods. You have two A4 pages of notes done up. None of us have read this book yet. Read about it, but haven't read it. So you're going to give us the verdict.
It's interesting. And so on Twitter, obviously, we highlighted that we were going to talk about the book. So a few people who have read the book were offering opinions and... I'm looking forward to discussing it because it is, and I think all of you at the end of it will, my aim is that you'll all go, okay, I'm going to read it now.
Okay, good. Excellent. So what's going on in the world? A few different things. Rory McIlroy has weighed into the Ryder Cup debate. He has said it needs fans. It looks very much like this thing is going to be postponed. And also Ewan Murray had it today in The Guardian, Nathan, that crucially NBC want crowds and they are paying a wedge load of cash to broadcast the Ryder Cup. So if the broadcaster wants something, generally the broadcaster will get it. So really, in effect, Padraig Harrington is going to have to be Ryder Cup captain for a whole extra year.
There's been a massive U-turn, it seems, from everybody on this from a month, 6 weeks ago. And here, listen, it's obviously a very fast developing situation. But when this first broke, we had Harrington on Off the Ball, who at the time was, no, I think we're going to want sport, we're going to want golf, and if it means going ahead behind closed doors, I think that's the best thing to do. Whereas Harrington's been out and about this week saying, nah, Ryder Cup without fans, it's just not the same, it shouldn't happen. So clearly the European Tour's attitude, because I think Harrington himself would probably admit he's reflecting whatever the Tour's view is, as he should be doing as captain. And the fact that the senior players, McIlroy in particular, like when McIlroy weighs into something, he's probably the strongest voice, certainly in, well, probably in world golf, because Tiger never says anything. So when Rory speaks, people are going to listen. And it'd be a hard enough sell, whatever about regular tour golf for NBC in terms of promoting it, like trying to build up the rivalry. Oh, we're showing this. It's going to be great because there's nothing else on. Like every other tournament is fine. Even like even majors, I think you could go with behind closed doors because needs must.
Yeah.
But the Ryder Cup is just about the support.
I'd also be interested to get a breakdown of how much money they make on site by having the 100,000 plus fans there across the week. Because certainly, Peter, I can vouch for this, and Nathan and Fionn can as well. The prices in the superstore with all the gear, there's a nice markup there. They're making a fair few quid, I would suspect, from food and selling apparel and all that kind of stuff. Have I apparel? Oh. Have I been infected with that as well?
Apparel.
I'm thinking there's about apparel spritzers.
Yeah, but remember Paul McGinley was on the show recently, and he had said something which I'd known already, but he reminded me of it. The European Tour don't make any money when the Ryder Cup leaves Europe. When it's in America, they don't make a penny. So really, Europe are not really bothered whether it goes well. I'm not saying they're not bothered, but in general, they won't be too pushed out that the Ryder Cup does not play this year, because of the financial aspect of it. But what you're saying is the American aspect of it is they're going to lose out substantially, as you say, on apparel, on food and beverages, on people coming to and from the golf course, the whole area where it's been played. So there's huge financial situations there that you have to consider playing the Ryder Cup. And I said from day one, Ryder Cup without gallery is not really the Ryder Cup.
Yeah, I think we're all coming around strongly to that opinion, Fionn.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not as in love with the Ryder Cup as others are, and certainly the likes of Dave McIntyre. And I mean, I would have happily watched the Ryder Cup with no fans. It wouldn't have bothered me, but if it doesn't make financial sense, then absolutely. I mean, I think probably there's a reflection of how it's probably not that high on the list of priorities for US golf. I mean, compared to the majors or just even the idea of getting the season started again. If it was given the choice between the Ryder Cup and having at least one major this year, it's a no-brainer for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, hopefully it looks like we're going to have lots of majors. Like the USPGA will be coming from San Francisco in August, Harding Park, and that seems like, you know, certainly if the PGA Tour is going to start on June the 11th, which we'll come on to in a second, then the USPGA is a great chance. The Masters in November looks to be locked in as anything can be at the moment. So in the midst of all that, you don't need the Ryder Cup as desperately. It's not like the Ryder Cup was your only option at golf. So
that's we can it here, I think. And you're right. Obviously, the golfing schedule doesn't work in calendar months. So if the 2020 season starts in September or the end of September, potentially next season would have six majors, because you would have a Masters, you would have the PGA, and then you would have obviously the Masters again in its traditional spot in April, US Open at Wingfoot September, and then one in Torrey Pines in June. And you would have the PGA Championship at Kiewer Island in May of next year, and Championship at Royal St. George's in July of next year. So six majors in 1 year. That'll be a bumper year for golf.
Yeah. Well, listen, who needs majors? Because we've got what we all wanted. Phil versus Tiger. This is on. This is just fantastic. Tom Brady and Peyton Manning are going to join in with Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. This will be on TNT. I presume one way or another, Sky will get their hands on it and dish it out to us.
100%.
Champions for Charity is what it's called. Obviously, it's raising money for COVID-19, so that's all great. No problem with that. There's very little detail on the nature of the match, but we're hearing it's going to be a 2-versus-2 contest, but we don't know the rules or handicaps or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, we do. We do. Peyton Manning plays off 6.4, and Tom Brady plays off 8.1 of a handicap. Peyton Manning's going to team up with Tiger and Tom Brady with Phil. Okay. So, I mean, that's pretty much, and this is according to Bleacher Report. The specific date and venue are going to be announced in the coming weeks. And clearly, so two things are working towards it. One is that the ignominy of having this kind of slightly offensive $9 million purse to two guys who have more money than they could ever spend for the rest of their lives. The fact that they're donating all the money, it's all for the COVID-19 charity. So that's taking care of the kind of slightly bad taste in your mouth of this thing happening. And the second thing is that there is literally nothing else to watch. So invariably, there'll be no distractions. So golf fans will all of a sudden find new reasons why to appreciate the super sassy back chat between two traditional rivals in both sports. So obviously Peyton Manning and Tom Brady were longtime rivals in the NFL, but as far as I know, also became very good friends. So even though they were the two dominant quarterbacks of their generation, they are good friends. And then of course you have Tiger and Phil.
So November 2018 was the $9 million match in Las Vegas, 22 holes. Phil took the money. There was no trash talk, but crucially as well, there was no interesting talk either. Now, if we put on like our producer's hat for a second here, say they're sitting around and they're trying to figure out, well, how do we make this thing better? Because it patently did not work in 2018. I think, Nathan, it's unrealistic to expect Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson to get into trash talking across 4 or 5 hours. It's just not going to happen. They need to find a way, though, to prompt some kind of interesting discussion. Now, I don't know if that means you get a very skilled broadcaster in there who on different fairways can bring up different topics or different memories. It's just to initiate something, because or else they're going to have to sit down with the two lads and almost map this out and say, look, we're going to have to think of a few stories, Ryder Cup memories, shared experiences, if there's a time you guys went head to head, and just without scripting the whole thing, 6th fairway, par 5, you have a long walk. Let's do that there. Let's get you mic'd up. So, okay, we're not going to get the impromptu, oh, wow, I forgot. Well, you might if you get started, but they never got started in the last match. They kind of avoided each other after the first hole because they were both so ashamed of how badly it had gone.
I would fear that it will be the opposite, that you just look if they've added in Peyton Manning and Tom Brady, that rather than trying to spice it up, they've added an extra layer of dullness. And rather than two people walking awkwardly down the fairway, we're going to have 4 people walking awkwardly down the fairway. They're raising a lot of money for charity. That's great. There's not a single person in the world, I felt, that looked at the first match and thought, God, can't wait for that again. What's interesting might well be what was said in that producers' meeting. They may have made an absolute bucket load of money the last time and thought, you know what? It worked just fine. You didn't have to give anything. All you have to do was turn up and play golf. You didn't have to give anything of yourselves. And we still all came away with bucket loads of money. So let's just do it all again. This time we give it all to charity. But you're right, it could be so much more. It's little prompts along the way, even the 1 or 2 on-course interviews that were done the last time were basically just telling them how great they were. There was nothing, and trying to stir up a little bit of very fake trash talking. But you would love to see a real uncut Phil Mickelson, his Tuesday match for a few grand when he's getting on Keegan Bradley's back. That's what you'd love to see. You'd love to see Tiger rock up in the green jacket. First tee. I wasn't really concentrating back in November 2018. You know, I was thinking about the next major, which you might remember, Phil, I won.
I'm open to all ideas. I really hope they brainstorm. I don't even care if there's some kind of cookie jar and they open it after they've hit their tee shots and then it poses a question or two that they have to discuss. Meanest player on tour. You know those anonymous
Yeah,
what player would you would be least likely to hop in for in the car park if he was getting beaten up, that kind of stuff? Or a broadcaster just to get in there and do it, because they're not going to do it themselves. Peter Lawrie, you'd be the man to get in there.
I would love to get in there and ask a few real tough questions. You know the way you say one
mute,
and done?
Mute.
I could be done after this, finally finished, if I asked the right questions.
Go out with a bang.
Yeah, it could be a sellout.
Will you watch this, Peter?
No. No, I probably will, to be honest.
100%.
Everybody's the same. Will you watch this? No. Wait a second. No. Another 5 weeks away and I won't have seen one bit of live sport.
Yeah.
I
just want to see it. It's probably like watching, a cringe-tastic movie or, something like that. And you want to watch it for the cringe factor more than anything else.
I think
Nathan's point.
Sorry, just the one thing I thought watching the last time, part of the issue here is the money doesn't mean anything.
No.
Either of these guys. So there was nothing to lose. So they were playing a skins game as they went along. And they were trying to hype this up throughout the holes that when they got to certain, this shot's now worth 180 grand.
Could be worth 180 million.
Get out of bed for
it. Yeah.
Yeah. It'll want to be. What's the punishment for the loser?
I know there's no, it's not like Phil won the last one. It's not like anyone is putting that into the argument of who's the better player, Phil or Tiger.
Mm.
There was that one-on-one match where Phil beat him, when it really counted. Oh,
where they had to make up remember what happened at the last, it went to a playoff?
It was like an off-the-ball quiz where no one had banked on a draw.
No, and they had to go, and they literally created a hole that was beside the car park, and they didn't have a tee box, and they basically just made up a tee box and played to a random hole.
Yeah, they both play terribly as well. That's another thing. At least if they both came out all guns blazing and started making some birdies and, they might get into it a bit more. But yourself, when you're not playing well, it's really hard to get stuck into something and get your teeth into it.
I think Nathan's point, though, is the best one of all, is the idea that if you could see an uncut version, because I have no doubt that Tiger and Phil together, it would be hilarious. Some of the stuff they would be saying to each other. I don't know, Tom Brady and Peyton Manning, maybe as well. These are charged, competitive monsters. So, that adrenaline would surely be coursing. But in terms of the money, the problem is that the audience didn't care the last time.
No,
whereas now... That. And now you do, because the idea is try and raise as much money for charity as you possibly can. So the stakes are at least legitimate rather than, hey, which one of you billionaires is going to pocket 9 million quid? And it's just like, yeah.
They should throw in a Trevino and a player, into the mix there rather than the two amateurs.
No.
Imagine having to do press-ups if you missed the putt with Gary Player.
No, but Phil Mickelson with Tom Watson.
Oh, even better.
The dream.
That would be glorious.
Brady and Manning bring in a huge mainstream audience. I don't even know. If we were sitting down with them, you'd say, I don't expect trash talk. I mean, honestly, and we don't expect you to be talking about X, Y, and Z, doing terrible things or being a bad person. You just, they think of the interesting golf chat they could have. That would be not explosive and not make headlines, but the insights they could give to different players or different moments
Phil being honest to Tiger about how Phil felt in the early 2000s,
that could be great too,
being the other guy. That could be incredible.
Did your mum really call me Fat Phil all those years?
Funny, when you talk about the trash talk, I was thinking about this yesterday when we were talking
more.
Connor was talking about spending time with Tiger, and that Tiger is one of the more down to earth in a way, one of the more unfiltered. And then you think back to the last book on Tiger, and that throughout that he's sort of unfiltered. That Tiger's trash talking is just, it's different to Phil's. Phil is probably corporate trash talk, knows how to get under your skin. Tiger's, you get the sense, is probably just a bit inappropriate.
Right.
Which I'm not sure you can bring to really a, national charity event.
You can't. I don't expect trash talking. I just want an interesting golf talk. Golf is a fascinating subject to talk about. When Tiger gets talking about golf in a press conference, if Tiger, when he's in the mood, is a 20, 30-minute press conference, somewhere around 18 minutes in, when they've stopped talking about his body and you know, all the other stuff. And he might just be talking golf, you know, hitting different shots or different lies or courses and approaches. He's just amazing, like encyclopedic stuff. You'd love if some of that could just come out, because Phil Mickelson knows so much. Like, he's a golf historian. You can only imagine. Phil's been playing since what, early 90s? If there's a way to encourage them to get that out, that'd be what I'd want from this thing. The trash talk thing, you know, that's not going to happen realistically. Well, the match, Champions for Charity. In fairness, it's for charity. So regardless of if it's any good, they're raising money. Fair play to them for doing that. June 11th, Texas. PGA Tour is back. But even I just saw today, the Scottish Open on the European Tour, which is on July 11th, so a month later, has been postponed. The BMW in Germany is gone. The French Open is gone. The PGA Tour are plowing ahead here. And they say they're very confident in making this happening. They think they'll need a million tests, kits to get them through the season. But they're still looking at June 11th and saying, yeah, that's us. That's up and running. They will, I would think, they'll be about the first sport getting back in a serious kind of regular way, I would think.
Yeah. They're hoping, so starting with the Charles Schwab Challenge, they want to play 14 more events for the 2019-2020 season. So when you include whatever it is, how many they've played a good chunk before the corona. So it would be something like, I think, 4/5 of the tour schedule or whatever, some substantial percentage, and then they would play 3 FedEx Cup events. So there is the potential for a truncated but still a fairly satisfactory season. Conversely, though, the European Tour, I mean, the European Tour's, part of the European Tour's problem is that the European Tour is spread across all these different countries that all have different regulations and restrictions. And so the European, Keith Pelly has to, you know, has to navigate like lots of things, whereas the PGA Tour, probably less so. But having said all of that, we don't know whether spectators are going to be allowed in. Clearly, if you were a betting person, you'd say no. I heard that the PGA Tour Chief Tournaments Officer, this guy Andy Pasder, and Chief of Operations Tyler Dennis were talking about the plans. And they said that the only people allowed on the course for now would be essential personnel. So this is players, caddies, tournament officials, rules officials, walking scorers, broadcast partner personnel, and a certain number of people from the host organizations. Now, even without fans, that's a fairly busy, you know, that's a lot of people walking around. You mentioned the coronavirus testing. Is there talking of the potential of testing players before they leave home, and then once again once they reach the host venue? And the fly in the ointment, or one of the other main flies in the ointment, is that in terms of overseas players who play in the PGA Tour, Pasder was saying that the tour is aware of 25 players who are outside of the US, as well as 35 caddies. And until international travel restrictions affecting those countries are lifted, those players would not be allowed. Obviously, they would be given no dispensation to play. Yeah.
I thought they were going to be given a dispensation.
Okay. Apparently not. Nope. And then the other question, this is all part of not a Q&A, but they were having kind of a discussion about it, and was put to them as, it's like, what about players who aren't comfortable with playing? And so this is interesting, right? We know that PGA Tour players are essentially independent contractors. So, you know, you can make the decision not to play. You have the luxury of creating your own schedule, as Peter has pointed out many times, you're your own boss. However, the fact that you don't play, then so it's almost as though the PGA are saying, well, it's up to you. You can come and play or you can stay at home. But if you stay at home, we're not going to make allowances for FedEx points. And if you're on the margin of perhaps playing for your card at the end of the season, be it on your own head. Uh-huh. That's the impression that I'm getting from the comments made, that they made no suggestions about making allowances for players who'd be nervous or saying, look, I'm not that comfortable playing. It's just like saying, look, if we run the event, it's a...
Can you imagine the lawsuits that are going to be at the end of the year if you miss out your card by a single point?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a complicated scenario. Like, how many players on the PGA Tour have asthma?
Yeah.
Is it safe for those players to go out? Listen, we all are desperate for something, some sense of normality and some sense of something returning, particularly after the last few days where it feels like it's been extremely depressing that this, we're not going to see anything before the end of the summer. It's hard to see how we see very much before the end of the year. And if we can't get it before the end of the year, why are we going to get it in 12 months' time if we can't get it in 8 months' time, if there is no vaccine? And even like, how long is that going to take? So any sense of getting something back, we're sort of keen to grasp onto. But so many different complications from, if they're not going to do what the Premier League is doing, which is basically saying, all right, we want 120 players. You have to commit to, say, a four-week spell where we're going to transport you all to the same hotels, same airplanes, and there's going to be this group and this billion-dollar deal. We're going to dip into it with NBC, and it's going to cost us a lot of money, but it will get golf on, then fine. But with the way this virus works, like, you could play alongside somebody on a Saturday. Don't know until the following week if you have it, by which time you've returned home to your family, maybe to your elderly parents, all to play a bit of golf. And I can understand where the PGA come from in that they can't make exceptions in terms of holding your card, but like, even who's going to play? Like, if I'm, if you're Tiger or Rory McIlroy, like, if you're Rory McIlroy, and I've no idea whether what his thoughts are on this, but he doesn't need the money. So what is the incentive, particularly for those first 2 or 3 months? Okay, if we get to September and there's a US Open about to happen, you think, all right, I can go and play a couple of FedEx Cup events and warm up for that if everything has gone quite smoothly. But you would be a little bit insane to be going out in those first 2 or 3 weeks unless you really had to.
I didn't realize we were at a point where you could test effectively instantly.
I think they can test within 7 hours. Okay. 6 hours, 7 hours.
Okay. Sure, that's so if you arrive, so you test before you leave home, and then when you get to the host venue, you arrive, say, on the, I guess, the Monday evening, you could test again, and then by Tuesday morning you'd know, and you're still a day and a half away from the first tee off. So, but I think Nathan,
is that guaranteed?
Well, I don't know. This is so what you see. The problem is this is also fluid. So I found the number. So before the shutdown, there was 22 events played. They've scheduled 14 events, so for a 36 tournament season, and so like, and it's. The impression I got, not so much that they're absolutely confident that this is exactly what's going to happen, but that until something changes, this is what they're planning to do. And there is such a gap between one and the other. So, I mean, not to unduly bring politics into it, but the force for reopening is gathering momentum in the United States at the moment. And so who knows? So we're recording this on a Thursday. By this time next week, who knows what the governors will have decided, that the economic impact of the shutdown has been so catastrophic for the United States that it could force a massive sea change. I mean, sorry, I hasten to add that at the moment, a majority of Americans still are in favor of a shutdown as a protective measure. But that could change. And so it could force the PGA Tour's hand, or conversely, the opposite could happen. They could see another spike in infections and deaths, and all of a sudden, despite whatever desire on the part of Trump and the administration or some of the governors, that they'll go, no, we can't do anything. So I think we're all a hostage to changing fortunes.
What do you think, Peter? What will the players make of all this? Will they take the risk, do you suspect?
I think a lot of them, I know Shane Lowry is in America waiting for it to restart. I saw somebody else on Twitter making a statement to say they decided to stay in America. So I think a lot of the guys will, you know what I mean, will get to the tournaments. An awful lot of people want to play golf. I don't really agree with Nathan, because I think they've been sitting at home now for so long. They don't care where it is. They're just going to play. If you follow that, say, if you follow the, you know, the Monday qualifiers, and he's been talking about different tours that are still going ahead. The Outlaw Tour, I think it's called. Like, there's a couple of guys playing in that. Like, Alex Checa is playing on that at the moment, just for summer to play golf. So I really think once the tour starts back up, I think they'll have full field, because an awful lot of people have been sitting at home doing, you know what I mean, twiddling their thumbs, trying to wait to get back out.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things I noticed just in terms of smaller tours is that for the European tour, that I saw Robert Rock was saying that Peter Hansen, remember him, has muted a solution for qualifying school, because Q school is not going to happen in the traditional way. So is that elevating all the national mini tours and at the end of the year have a final series. So you'd have, you allow for enough time to go by and so for things to get a little bit back to normal. And so the top guys could then qualify for the tour card. So you could have the EuroPro Tour in Britain, for instance, where they wouldn't be forcing players to play in the Challenge Tour and travel around Europe, but you could elevate that EuroPro Tour and all the other national tours. So you could have whatever, the Irish PGA, and say those guys, the top guys from each of those could then come together at the end of the year and have like kind of a new format Q school. And then you would have qualifiers for the European tour for next year, because obviously that's a huge concern for players now.
Mm. Oh yeah. But to be honest with you, Fionn, I think they're going to play so few events on the European tour that they're really going to just wipe the season out.
You think,
it's not
going
to count for anything, and you just go, you'll revert to your 2019 category going into 2021.
Keith,
because they can't play any golf tournaments until probably September.
Yeah, that's a good point. And one of the things that Keith Pelly, he's saying he's looking at options. So he's saying they're looking at things like multiple tournaments in the same location, two tournaments in the same week, three in a fortnight, or three or four tournaments back-to-back in the UK, and then allowing for a 14-day quarantine period ahead of that to allow players who aren't from the UK to come over and self-isolate in advance. And obviously, that's if the health requirement is still in place by then. So they're... And interestingly, what I was reading as well is that as much as they might feel under pressure from Sky to... Sky are not in the business of crushing the European Tour. They realize that if you kill the European Tour, then Sky have nothing. So oddly enough, despite having seemingly at kind of opposite ends of the table in terms of the discussion, they're both kind of trying to figure out what the most viable solution is. So Sky are willing to kind of hold on. I mean, they've obviously invested money in the tour, but equally the European Tour is like going, look, you know, we're going to try and make this work. So it's interesting to watch Pelly this stuff, because they're obviously desperate to figure out a solution, but at the moment they have bigger problems than the PGA Tour does.
Absolutely. And didn't I heard, I don't know, probably I saw it on Twitter or something like that.
Oh, definitely true.
Keith Pelly sent out,
and you should definitely repeat it.
Keith Pelly sent out a letter to all the players stating that the fact that the European Tour will not be the same as left.
Far fewer purses.
Yeah, purses are gone. Courtesy car is gone. Players' lounge is gone. You know, appearance money, which was probably one of the bugbears of a lot of players out there, might be gone too. Because the sponsors, who's going to put that money in at this moment in time when the world economy is where it is?
You said Keith Pelly sent out that letter to players this week.
No, I think it was last week.
I think it was sent out.
Yeah. Yeah. Just, but I mean, he's not saying anything that they all don't know already, you know, so.
It's going to be
a bit of a bubble, and they realize, you know, when they come back out, they'll think, where's my courtesy car? Where's the players' lounge? Yeah. They've never dealt with hardship before.
Well, I have a quote from this memo that was sent out. It was earlier in the month. And here is, the reality is the pandemic is going to have a profound impact on the tour financially, as well as many of our partners, both in sponsorship and broadcast areas. And he also warned of a radically different, quote, look to tournaments when play resumes. So this speaks to Peter's point about courtesy cars gone. All of the kind of little ancillary benefits of being a European Tour pro. No, you'll be schlepping your own. clubs. Here's a question though. So if you have, like, if you're going to maintain social distancing, how does a caddy clean your clubs and hand them to you? They don't.
No.
If golf is to continue the way it has for hundreds of years, the caddy will sterilize the club before he gives it to the player. But then the player will just hand it back to the caddy and he's got to take his chances.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
It is going to be, it's going to be devastating in so many ways, because like the golf sponsorship market, I'd imagine, was a bit of a struggle. Like, you just look at the Irish Open and the trouble the Irish Open was in a few years ago before Rory got involved and committed to it. Yeah. You would have thought, even in this country, the attraction for so many companies to get involved with that would have been huge, but they couldn't get anybody. So, like, where there's so many tournaments around the place that are going to find themselves in a similar situation. And then there's the broadcasting side of it, which is probably fascinating in a load of different ways. It does seem as though, like, Sky have probably come to the realization, and this in the Premier League as well, there was an initial fear, I think, that maybe Sky were going to withhold the money. Whereas obviously Sky are looking at this thing, well, if we withhold the money, half of these events are going to collapse and they're going to kill it, and we'll have nothing to broadcast when it comes back. So, yeah, I don't know. It all just feels still like it's week after week. It's developing so quickly. It's impossible to tell. And like, are we back to maybe not a Saudi Arabian sponsored world tour, but some form of a world tour at the end of this?
Yeah. It's everything's up in the air. One last incidental point, but it was kind of interesting. Brooks Koepka was asked about playing behind closed doors, Peter, and he was saying scores will be slightly higher. I mean, not guaranteed, but he wouldn't be surprised, he said, because there's no crowd there. One, obviously, crowds can ultimately be hit by balls and balls bounce back into fairways. He also said crowds find a lot of balls. You know, I sometimes am playing, and or we're all playing, and we lose a ball, and I sometimes think, geez, a pro wouldn't have lost a ball here because someone would have been right by it when it landed and would have seen it. So there's going to be more lost balls. And then also he was saying as well, especially around greens, if you hit very wayward shots, the old grandstands are quite handy. So that's all gone now.
Back to the olden days, you know, nobody on the golf course, and you whack it into the rough and you actually have to go look for your golf ball.
Yeah.
And now the new rules, you only get 3 minutes. So it's not the 5 minutes anymore.
Peter, do you think that's why a lot of players don't shout four? Is because they want the crowd, or the possibility of the crowd kind of bouncing the ball back into play?
You certainly get a few players. I remember playing in Australia, and this guy was going for the green, and he hit it straight towards the gallery. And I'm thinking, this is about halfway, and I'm looking at him, I'm looking at the ball, I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking to myself, is this guy going to shout or not? So I decided to walk right beside him and roar as loud as I could, four. And he kind of jumped, you know, to the side. And I said, well, what are you doing? You know, I said, well, you know, why aren't you shouting? Oh, well, I didn't think what? You know, this kind of, you know, the mentality is they matter more than somebody getting hit on the head with the golf ball. And yes, I would agree with you. They definitely, there is players out there that have, they don't care about anything else other than where my ball is going to end up.
Yeah. Not a shocking revelation, I must say, but pretty grim, especially when you think what happened to Koepka at the Ryder Cup. That woman blinded is often still something that crops up when you think about it.
I brought up a thing, and it was knocked out of the park in a players' meeting. About children being at a golf tournament. And I said, it has to stop. Or we give them hard hats. Because if you hit a child with a golf ball, more than likely you're going to kill them. Because, you know, the ability to bounce back from something like that. And I was kind of thrown out on, oh, kids are the thing. And I says, well, it'll happen someday that somebody's pushing. And what used to get me was in the Nordic countries, you used to get it the most. Families used to come out to the... So you'd have two or three small kids walking around the place, and then you'd have one in the rucksack with its head bobbling around the place fast asleep. And I just think to myself, we are just... It's going to happen eventually. But thank God it hasn't happened as of yet.
Yeah, that's a dreadful scenario you've painted there. Right, we want Fionn to review the book very, very quickly. Like, give me just even one answer here. I'm just curious, Peter. Bryson DeChambeau was on Twitch during the week. This is obviously yet another platform I'm not young enough to be on, but he was on Twitch. And he was saying, I think 45 and a half inch driver is what he uses and what a lot of the players use. This is kind of the question. He's saying he's going to go up to the 48 inch driver, which is the limit at where the USGA draw the line. He was saying, if they allow me to play the 48 inch driver, I think I might go up to that. He's completely obsessed with being longer off the tee. What length driver did you hit with? What was the average? What was the thinking there? Obviously, the longer it is.
I always went a little bit smaller. Right. It suited me better. And when I started hitting it sideways, I went for very, very short.
What's very, very short? How long is very, very short?
Well, your average driver is what? It's 46, 45 and a half, those between those two. But when I came out on tour, Jarmo Sandelin, he definitely had 48, but I think he actually went a little bit higher. And he savvy beat him in a playoff, I think, and he had the 48 inch driver in the bag at that time. But he used to carry two drivers, I believe. But he, like Bryson, was obsessed by length and kind of standing out.
And how much more difficult is a 47, 48 inch driver as opposed to a 43 inch driver if you weren't that confident? Is it a massive jump?
Oh, it's a huge difference. Absolutely huge difference. Like, even a quarter of an inch makes a big difference in the feel factor. So you're talking about 2 inches. It's just massive. And trying to get that with such a long, access now you have to go with, keeping it on the golf course will be quite difficult.
Should amateurs be playing with shorter drivers?
I would always say slightly shorter and a little bit more loft would help an awful lot of amateurs.
Yeah.
Dan, they always think amateurs come into the game, especially quite good amateurs. They come into the game and they go, right, I want stiff, 40, 45, 46 inch, 46 inch driver normally with 8 degrees loft or 9 degrees loft, when they should be actually thinking a little bit shorter and a little bit more loft, keep the ball in play a whole lot better.
Okay, very interesting. So we're going to talk about the Michael Bamberger book. Nathan, you have to shoot, do you?
Yes, got to go do some actual work. There's only so many golf weeklies we can get away with in 1 week.
All right, Nathan Murphy, bowing out for the time
being.
Take
it easy, lad.
Thank you. See you later. Fionn, Michael Bamberger has written a book about Tiger Woods. So let's... if we use the Armin Kettian book, the Tiger Woods book, which is brilliant, and I suspect a lot of listeners to the pod will have read, that is pretty much a root and branch, pretty linear tale of the Woods' life and times from childhood through. So it was fairly obvious what they were trying to do in that book, which was just tell the story in as complete a way as possible from childhood right through to adulthood. Michael Bamberger, big reputation, excellent writer. What's he trying to do? What's the format of the book?
So obviously with the previous biography looms large, and it casts Tiger in such a negative light largely. This book is trying to make an argument that his woes, particularly related to injury, have provoked a sea change in Tiger's attitude towards himself and to the world around him. So hence it's called The Second Life of Tiger Woods. And how he's recovered from the low points to win the 2019 Masters. So it ends with him winning the 2019 Masters, but kind of moves back and forth. And it kind of jumps back in time. But really it tells the tale, say, from 2009 onwards, but really with a focus on the last 2-3 years. And what's interesting, much more sympathetic portrait of Tiger than what's your man's name? I can never remember. What's his name? Armin.
Two journalists. One of them is Armin Kettian. I always remember him because we had him on the show.
Armin Kettian, yeah. So it's a much more sympathetic. It's also not as forensic. It's more like Bamberger Bamberger, as you said, he's like a, you know, he's a very well-respected sports writer. He was with Sports Illustrated for a long time. I think he's, who's he with now, ESPN or Golf Magazine he writes for. What he is, and first just a kind of a word about him. I think what I like about Bamberger, he's a great kind of observer of the human condition. So he understands fundamentally that the complex nature of what motivates us, you know, is that nobody's all good, nobody's all bad, that there's often contradictory drives that force us into situations that, yes, we might want to be the best and crush all in front of us, but we also want to be loved and we want to be respected. We want to punish those that we feel have hurt us, but we also want to be close. You know, he portrays Tiger in that way. So he also, I mean, he makes a point to say Tiger didn't talk to him for this book. He didn't, but he spoke to people around who know Tiger. And also he kind of draws on years and years and years of observing golf. This is the guy who famously played golf with Trump, like, I don't know, like 8 or 9 times. And so he'd be kind of in golf. And so the kind of take homes are this. One, Tiger Woods symbolizes the new rules that apply to celebrity superstars. And so he makes a point of saying this, that Tiger's infidelities didn't affect him at all. He was like, I wasn't offended by it. And really what he's doing is he's taking kind of square aim at those that were. And he's going, you're all hypocrites, you know? Like this pearl clutching that went on is, for instance, one of the things that he heard anecdotally is that Tiger really hated Billy Payne's that comp, that Tiger has let us down, he's let himself down. The Tiger's kind of looked at this and said, you know, the hypocrisy of you people is outrageous. This idea that somehow standing in front of the press with this apology was unprecedented. And it was. Nobody's ever had to do that before. So that's how he frames it. Then the second thing is that the book is very interesting on his relationship with other players. So how he treated his fellow professionals and how they see him has obviously long been established. Everybody sees he's the ghost that lays the golden egg. Nobody will ever say a bad thing about Tiger publicly, but privately, Tiger never really had that many good friends in golf. He was quite isolated. He lived in this bubble of his own and so on. But in the last couple of years, that seems to have changed. And Bamberger has tons of examples of how he gets on with players. Like, for instance, so his relationship with Greg Norman, which when Tiger Woods first came up as an amateur, he played with Greg Norman when Greg Norman was number one in the world and he was looking to asking Greg for tips, et cetera, et cetera. But then turned frosty on him for whatever reason. And there's a great story that, and not that long ago, that he, in Jupiter Island, Greg Norman and his wife are in the car and they draw up at a drawbridge to cross onto the mainland. And Tiger's sitting in the car next to them. So Kristen, Greg Norman's wife, rolls down the window and Greg Norman leans in and goes, "Hey, Tiger," like this. And Tiger just completely ignores him and just drives off. And Norman's like, "What the hell was that all about?" When Tiger won the Masters last year, Greg Norman wrote him a note saying, "Hey, go and do a Federer. You know, that was amazing. Well done." And got no response from Tiger. So it's like thinking, oh my God, this is the old Tiger. But they met at some event. And the two of them had this incredibly warm conversation, like absolutely like no problems, and clearly sorted out whatever beef there might have been. And so Norman is like still perplexed as to why Tiger ignored him at the drawbridge. But he says, we have no problems. Like when we saw each other, it was brilliant. He talks about his friendship with Olathabal, which they get on really, really well. He tells us there's a beautiful anecdote in it. In the practice days before the Masters, where he and Ollie are doing kind of a chipping lesson for the gallery. And something you said earlier on, Joe, is that listening to Tiger talk about golf is really incredibly interesting. Is that you have two of the, like, who Bamberger reckons are the two best chippers of the ball ever. Tiger reckons Ollie is the best chipper of a ball he's ever seen, and Olathabal thinks Tiger is the best chipper of a ball. And so they did this amazing clinic for the gallery, for the fans, which again, Bamberger points out, Tiger never would have done this before. And he's doing these things now, really organically, really naturally. He talks about his relationship with Phil Mickelson, which has totally transformed. It's well established. You know, you mentioned it earlier on, is that like Tiger really admired Phil's talent, but was very mean about his physique, would say, you know, make nasty jokes about Phil putting on weight, so on and so forth. And he thought that all of the signing autograph stuff was really phony and all the rest of it. But then Bamberger introduces something, and it's this. It's about the relationships that they each had with their respective fathers. So Phil's dad was very reserved, much like Tiger is, whereas Phil is always the kind of natural show-off, the guy who always wants to entertain, always wants to be seen as the guy who knows the stuff, much like Earl Woods was. So Earl Woods, who Bamberger would have known quite well back in the day, Earl never shut up, ever. Like, he was a bit like, he had a bit of the Don King about it, you know, really, really bright man, but constantly performing. And Tiger, according to Bamberger, is reacting to Earl Woods. So he posits the question is, maybe that kind of frostiness with Phil had to do with the fact that maybe subconsciously, Phil reminds Tiger of his own father. So it's the
We're verging on pop psychology there.
No, no, you see, but this is it. This is why Bamberger is not, he's not saying this is why. Like all good writers, you allow for the possibility. That's the thing. Like, it's you're not sitting there writing a book, well, I think Tiger is this because of that. He goes, well, you know, given this set of things, it's not impossible. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. Bamberger's too smart to say X, Y equals Z. But what he does is he creates, like all good writers, he knows how to paint a picture where you kind of sit there and you know, you can draw your own conclusions. It's a bit quoting like David Faraday, Tiger's failures are more interesting than other golfers' successes. And that comes absolutely out in this book, that Tiger is a kind of a centrifugal force that draws attention whether you want it to or not. He is an amazingly interesting individual by dint of what he's done for the game and by dint of his own behavior, even though it might be abhorrent to some, it's still fascinating to watch. And Bamberger is very much of that school of like, look, you know, I'm not friends with Tiger. Tiger's not my friend. I've never been able to interview him, but observing him over the last 25 years has been the singular most interesting thing I've done as a golf writer. And that is really what this book is about. And, you know, if I'm not selling it to you properly, Bamberger is a terrifically intelligent man. He really, really is. Certainly it comes through. I've always been a big fan. He speaks a lot to Bob Jones IV, who's the grandson of Bobby Jones and a psychologist. And they talk about Tiger in relation to that. And like, Bob Jones doesn't have a relationship with Tiger, but as far as he's concerned, this is what has happened to Tiger on the back of injury has transformed him completely. And he's convinced of it. And he says, like, I observe him at Augusta. I watch the way he is. I watch the way he interacts with other players. I watch the way he interacts with fans. Like, for example, watch that moment at Augusta when Tiger's walking from the green to a tee where he's actually handshaking, fist bumping. Have you ever seen Tiger do that before? No. Tiger never did that before. And all of a sudden, he's allowing the world to come in. And ultimately, you got to ask, you answer your own question. Is it because Tiger Woods realizes that his career came to an end? It was over. And he's been given this second chance, and now he's just grateful for it. So this is effectively what the book is about. I found it really interesting. Even the musings, even the kind of wonderings, I found really interesting because they're written by a pretty intelligent guy. And so what it does is, it doesn't take anything away from the previous biography. Tiger is a complicated and in some, not a particularly appealing person to be around, I'm sure. But on the back of this, that maybe there is, maybe I am more convinced that he's a changed individual.
Okay, very interesting.
It's really, really good. There's a great quote at the end of the book, and here I'll just read it to you. Tiger's 15th major was different from the 14 before it. He didn't win it as Earl's son. He won it as Charlie and Sam's father. He didn't win it walled off from his fans. He won it bringing his fans in. And that's ultimately what Bamberger is observing. Now, obviously, he's talking to a ton of people who, you know, who operate in that world. And this is the picture that they're painting. That question we've asked, is it just done for the cameras? Is Tiger doing this simply because he realizes he's got to be nicer? It's no. It's because he is fundamentally, something happened. Something happened to him. He reached such a low point with those injuries and sitting at that Augusta dinner and turning around and going, I'm done. This is it. I'm done. Mm. And so to get that second chance is that perhaps, you know, and basically he's allowing that people have capacity for change. So it's a pretty optimistic book.
Yes. Yeah.
Fionn, has that not happened with quite a few other players in relation to reaching the top of their sport or top of their game? And then all of a sudden they hit the downward slope and they lose it all. Do you not think they become nicer people when they've actually hit rock bottom and they're working their way back up because they've lost everything? They've lost all the ability to self-worth that they had, and that seems to have disappeared. And now they're having to, you know, how do I get back? How do I create myself again? And
okay,
they realize that they kind of need other people around them rather than just this one way of doing things.
Okay. And you're absolutely right. Failure does make us more humble. There is no doubt about it. Failure, I won't name names, but I knew someone who was very successful and then who lost everything and just became a lot nicer on the back of it. Yeah. And you're absolutely correct. What makes Tiger Woods an exceptional is that ever since he appeared at the Mike Douglas Show at the age of two, he has lived in a bubble of impenetrable greatness. Even before, like when he was winning US amateurs, when he was breaking records, that Tiger Woods never had a period in his life where he was a normal kid. Tiger Woods grew up in an abnormal world that 99.9% of us can't even imagine, never mind experience. And so what makes it more remarkable, and I'm kind of getting into the Bamberger psyche here, what makes it more remarkable is that here's a man at the age of 41 who has never, ever known anything else, all of a sudden can have a kind of a psychic change. And you're absolutely right. It's not unheard of for successful people to fall and then kind of rebuild themselves and feel, oh, I need to make changes. But successful people also had a time when they weren't successful. And you can make this argument that Tiger Woods has never even known what that was. He's never known anything else. And so he posits the idea, it's a bit like Michael Jackson. Like Michael Jackson was the breadwinner for his family from the age of five. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that do to you? Where all of a sudden, and the corollary of being that person in that bubble is that you are given allowance to do things that other people just can't do, and it's perfectly okay. And I don't mean illegal things. I just mean you can behave in ways that would be considered abominable for normal people. And so Tiger Woods, growing up in this bubble of superstardom from the age of two, I won't say the word miraculous, but it's almost... It would go against the odds that Tiger Woods, simply on the back of it, that you can kind of, you can turn around and like, I started watching that Last Dance, that Michael Jordan documentary on Netflix. Now, Michael Jordan is the most successful athlete in the history of American sport, in absolute global terms, even more than Babe Ruth before him. And certainly he shades Tiger Woods because Jordan is Jordan. But Jordan knew what it was like. Before Jordan became Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan was just Mike Jordan, this kid learning basketball. And he, that kind of bubble, he didn't go into that bubble until he was 19 or 20. And when he was at the University of North Carolina, Tiger Woods never even had that first 18 years. Like right from the start, Tiger was this kind of this, as I said, like the only comparable example I can think of is a Michael Jackson. who from the earliest age was just all of a sudden, you know, one of the most famous people in the world. And so as a result, what makes it exceptional is that it, if it is indeed true that Tiger has had this awakening or a second life, is that he's going absolutely against the odds of it being possible. And I think that's what makes the book such a compelling read, is that you, and Bamberger makes a very good case for that actually being the case.
Yeah.
Very good. No, I'll check it out, because I did read in that interview Bamberger did with Paul Kimmich a couple of weeks ago, he was saying the plans for the book, the genesis of the book was observing Tiger in a couple of interviews post his return from the scandal and from the injury. And he noticed a different Tiger, and a couple of weeks later saw him again, a different Tiger. And so that's where the idea for the book came, to almost investigate, what are we seeing here? Is this a transformation, an awakening? Is this a more cynical ploy where they need to soften his image? And, you know, and he does what he might have accused Phil Mickelson of doing a decade previously, and you know, high fives the fans.
Yeah.
Or is it a more substantive inner awakening development, which may have come, by the way, without the injuries and without the scandal? It may just have come with age. We all grow a bit more, you know, vulnerable in our age. And that's the interesting thing. I mean, to state the obvious, God, you'd love to hear from Tiger on this in an environment
absolutely
where he's comfortable to say everything. Because even when he did win the Masters, various athletes did, who knew him semi-well, I don't know how well, but did express the sentiment that, well, nobody knew really just how low it had become, got for you, or how low you had sunk, you know. And maybe none of us really know just how down he was, or just how much he was struggling, emotionally, spiritually, as much as everything. And maybe, well, you know, when he thought it was over, he might have looked back at the 14 majors and all the money and all the success and the reputation and thought to himself, what was that all about? Was that a bit, is that a bit pointless? Is that a bit hollow? You know, he got to confront his legacy in its totality and reflect on it from a couch. And then he got to go back out and get an extra few years. So it's not, you know, beyond the bounds that he looked at it and thought, that aspect actually was more important to me. That aspect being his reputation is more important to me than I had thought.
What year did he nearly win the Open in Carnoustie?
18.
Against
2018. Yeah, that was when he was like, oh my God, he's back here, you know?
He's back. Joe, I think everything you've said is absolutely spot on. Listen, I've been on the pod. I think we've done the pod for like 10 years now. and listeners to the pod will know that I've always been the first to kind of, you know, to arch a cynical eyebrow when I see people bringing their kids onto the green, or all of a sudden bringing children into the thing. I always feel there's something. But one of the things that this book did is it really convinced me that, you know, Tiger was rich 20 years ago. Tiger was rich to the point that he never had to do another day's work as long as he lived 20 years ago. So it's not about money. He was famous beyond the reach of most mortals 20 years ago. So he's had a long time to get used to all of this. So as you said, perhaps that thing of all of a sudden realizing, you know what, my kids really, really matter. And is that really that surprising, given that Tiger's relationship with Earl was the singular most important relation, actually, in fairness, also with his mum, because Bamberger really points out that that kind of, that real ice cold, he doesn't get from Earl, he gets it from his mum. But his relationship with his parents, who had such an overwhelming effect on this young boy, is it surprising at all that Tiger understands the power of parenting? That all of a sudden with Charlie and Sam, he realizes, now is my turn to make that relationship. And Bamberger really makes a very convincing argument that he is very much Charlie and Sam's father. That relationship with his kids is really, really important to him.
No, I get that. The one to play the cynic for a second, I've stepped into that role. Everybody who has kids, understands the importance of parenthood, and you know, everybody's primary thing in their life is their kids. Once they have kids, it seems. I don't have kids, but they, like anyone who has, that's what they say. And secondly, Tiger talks about them a lot in a very, conscious way, I would think. Like a lot of questions, the answers find their way back to his kids, and it's a real kind of thing that he does. Like, I can't think of another PGA Tour player who talks about their kids more at the moment. So that doesn't happen by accident. For an intensely private individual, he's not unaware that he's doing that. Now, that might be one, to help soften the image. Two, it's probably a neat enough way to divert questions he doesn't want to answer, spin it around towards his kids, into happy, I've got some tiger. So, you know, it could also be a shield in a way, as opposed to him putting his kids out front and center to try and say, look at me.
Which goes back to the very first point I made that I like about the way Bamberger writes is because he understands that people have conflicting motivations. Mm. That simply because one is true, it doesn't mean the other isn't also true. That's what makes the complex nature of human beings. One of the other, and I forgot to mention this earlier on, in terms of his relationship with players, as another telling sign of new Tiger versus old Tiger, is that a nailed-on anecdote that apparently is 100% true, is that Rory McIlroy rings Tiger about his swing. Now, they're not best pals, but they do get on. They obviously respect each other. And so that Rory, if Rory, say, for example, Rory notices something in Tiger's swing, that he would ring him and go, oh, I noticed that. And can you imagine someone doing that to Tiger 10 years ago? He'd be like, what? You're out of your mind. But apparently Tiger goes, hey, thanks, man. That's cool. That Tiger is now, he recognizes that he needs, maybe not help is the right word, but he needs to be open. And again, this is a kind of it just posits this persona. Now, I'm not suggesting that Tiger all of a sudden is, you know, the Pied Piper of kindness or, you know, the guy that you want at every party. I don't mean that. I just mean is that you have this man who has been so singularly private. What's the name of his yacht? Isn't it Privacy is the name of his boat? This is a guy who's put privacy amongst above everything else, is now much more, maybe the word is softer. He's a softer human being. And the joke goes back to your point. Maybe it just came with age. Maybe, like, I'm 52 years old. I'm way more emotional, way more, you know, I'm much softer now than I would have been 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, maybe because, you know, the finite notion of life comes into play a lot more.
I haven't hit that soft phase yet, Fionn.
you should have seen me 20 years ago.
I'm still hard and cynical.
You're not, though. You're not really. I think there's another interesting one is that there's a little bit of sleuthing here in terms of, you know, there's the relationship with Donald Trump and Tiger, who is very, very careful never to reveal his politics to anybody. But sometimes you got to read between the lines. So, like, Trump adores Tiger. Like, Trump constantly talks about Arnie and Tom Watson and Tiger as his favorites. Like, he loves these three, and he's I'm assuming, played with them all. And I know he's played with Tiger. But what are Tiger's true feelings? Well, you wouldn't really know, except for when he was asked. Do you remember when Colin Kaepernick made that ad for Nike? Mm-hmm. Now, a really kind of circumspect Tiger who doesn't want to offend anybody would say very little, but he didn't. What he did, he said he loved the ad. He thought it was amazing. So
the Nike ad. He loved the Nike ad.
Yes.
The ad by Nike. Interesting.
Yes. No. But here's the thing. That was bigger than Nike.
Would he have loved the Adidas ad as much? Maybe.
No. My point is this. My point is this. Colin Kaepernick is one of the most. He's one of the most incendiary figures. And in U.S. golf, which would traditionally be way more right-wing than other sports, is to say that you love the Colin Kaepernick ad, which is basically saying you love Colin Kaepernick. Because the polarizing effect of Kaepernick is such that, like, to even lend support to anything that involves Colin Kaepernick is really to make quite a statement in those narrow, defining terms.
I get that,
and then the other thing.
But again, with Tiger, like ambiguity reigns because it's also a Nike ad. It's a Nike ad, and you can't. I mean, if it was an Adidas ad and he came out and said, "I love that ad," I'd be thinking, "Okay, interesting." But there is a degree of ambiguity there. There is, Fionn. I'm sorry. You can't separate.
My point is this.
If I say to you Nike, you say to me Jordan and Woods.
Yeah, sure. But at the same time, is that like going forward, do you not think, look, you and I were, it's a healthy back and forth. I don't know. I really don't.
Sorry, either do I. I don't know either, but I'm just saying it's interesting in that there's a lot of ambiguity. There's a lot of with Woods at the moment. And I think Bamberger said this to Paul Kimmich a couple of weeks ago. There is a real element of, well, let's see where this goes. We don't know yet what we're seeing here in Woods.
But Tiger's in the twilight of his career. Like, you know, it's not as if Tiger's going to be a dominant figure in golf for the next 15 years. He's not. He's enjoying the last few years, the last hurrahs, whatever. Like, yeah. You know, I'm sure he'll be around for, you know, he's obviously kept himself in good shape. My point is this. Do you not think there's also the possibility that his relationship with Nike, his primary sponsor, has also shifted because of success? That if 20 years ago, a young Tiger Woods, who has just signed his first X million dollar deal with Nike, is going, oh, you know, blah, 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 Nike. But now, 20 odd years later, it's like, yeah, you know, I'm not saying that he's going to take a shot at Nike. But also, do you think, does he have the same relationship with the sports brand that has made him immensely wealthy, but also he has made them immensely wealthy? You know,
again, we don't know. You could twist it both ways. You could say he needs more than ever as he segues into retirement and still wants to have a ginormous lifetime deal.
But do you not think that, am I naive here, but is Tiger Woods not a billionaire who literally could live exactly the way he does and never lift another finger for the rest of his life?
Probably. But look, another million never hurts.
No. He got wealthy people. And then the other little kind of throwing aside is that he pointedly refers to Donald Trump as Donald. He calls him Donald, not Mr. the President. He calls him by his first name.
Yeah.
Which is, you can say it's either a sign of, yeah, we're friends, or he's throwing shade at him. He's going, who, Donald? Mm. You know?
So
anyway, the book is full of
I'd say it could be the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In the respect terms.
Also remember, I mean, and again, like Earl Woods was quite a radical, you know? This is he was no right winger. This is Earl Woods who when he was alive, obviously, was making comments that suggested that Tiger Woods was going to really put it up to this white establishment, you know? Like, Earl never, ever was not a shrinking violet when it came to issues around civil rights. And so, you know, you never know. Anyway, it's worth a read. That's the point.
Okay. Now I'll try and check it out over the next while. Right, we've gone way over time. Peter Lawrie, we'll let you get home. Do you have to mow more grass, or are you going home?
No, I have to try and get the green back. So, yeah, I have to mow a little bit more grass, yeah.
Okay, well, we'll let you go and do that. Fionn, thanks.
We're working on our short game facilities.
Well, excellent. I mean, I guess you might hope come May 5th or certainly June you're back in action.
I would hopefully kind of middle of May, I would have said. Okay. You know, probably not the first couple of weeks, but maybe the week after that.
Okay, sure. We'll see what happens. Thank you. And Fionn, thanks for reviewing the book. Much appreciated.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
all right,
guys.
Fellas. Thanks. We'll talk to you next week. Golf Weekly on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.